Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Governor Carney unveiled his 2018 budget proposal this week. We discuss his plans to overcome a $386 million shortfall with political reporter James Dawson. State Rep. John Kowalko recently visited the UK to learn how it moved to the forefront of wind energy. And he says what he learned can be applied here.
I think the potential is unlimited. It gives us jobs for installation and jobs for maintenance and jobs for operation.
We talk with Kowalko about the prospects of rebooting Delaware's offshore wind efforts. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also sit down with Senator Tom Carper to talk Trump budget, Obamacare repeal, and more. And look at how Trump cuts could impact the Delaware Sea Grant. Plus, our arts playlist previews the upcoming 2017-2018 Delaware Theater Company season. The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground, is next. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Governor John Carney unveiled his first budget, a $4.1 billion spending plan for 2018 that evenly splits tax hikes and spending cuts to try and fill a projected $386 million revenue shortfall. Carney says shared sacrifice was one of his primary guiding principles, making the drafting of this plan, quote, an exercise in making very tough decisions, unquote. Political reporter James Dawson covered the budget rollout and the initial reaction, and he joins us now to sort out the winners and losers and look ahead to what's next. James, thanks for being here.
Hey, good to be here, Tom.
Well, let's start with the couple of headline items here. Tax hikes, education cuts, and another stab at dealing with state employee health care benefits. Walk us through what Carney's proposing here.
So most immediately, people would notice their income tax rising between 0.2 and 0.4%, while their standard deductions also go up to try and offset this hike for those making less money. Itemized deductions, though, are out. The world's biggest companies are going to chip in the biggest chunk if lawmakers do increase the franchise tax, and that's going to raise about $115 million, and that's not going to affect LLCs or small businesses. They raised those rates a couple years ago. They say, you know, we can't do that. It's too soon. And then some of these cuts are fairly significant. You have $37 million that funnel to local school districts. That would be gone under the plan. Now, districts could recover $22 million of that by raising their local property taxes without a referendum, we should say. And that could face significant backlash in areas that haven't passed a referendum in a while. As for state employee health care benefits, Carney says he wants to cut it overall by $6.5 million, but he's leaving that decision on how up to a state committee.
And we'll talk about that in a minute, but first let's go back to the personal income tax hike. That's already getting some pushback from both sides. Republicans not interested in tax hikes at all. Democrats feel, at least some of them, they should be targeting higher income individuals only, or perhaps, as one lawmaker, John Kowalko, is suggesting, making some new higher brackets to draw money from those higher income earners. How hard a needle is this going to be for Carney to thread, considering he's getting pressure from both sides?
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be significantly hard. Like, it's going to be a lift, but I don't think it's going to be the biggest issue he has on his plate. I mean, progressive Democrats don't make up much of a faction in the House or Senate, and they're the ones really pushing for this new bracket above the current ceiling of $60,000 a year. I mean, you've had bills introduced over the past couple years to try and add them, but they've really never made it to the floor. Republicans are a bit wary, but they haven't had a knee-jerk reaction to this or dismissing the idea entirely. And the lawmakers I've spoken with have actually been pretty reserved compared to reactions I've gotten from past budgets from Governor Jack Markell.
And the one thing we should point out is if you're going to do this, this would be the year to do it. It's a non-election year.
Right. Correct. So it'll be much easier politically to accomplish.
Let's go to the education front. It seemed lawmakers were okay with not funding WEEC's education plan because of this deficit the state faces. But are they likely to endorse cuts to schools? I imagine they're going to hear a lot from a number of constituencies in the state about this type of cut to education.
Yeah, and this is likely the biggest challenge that they're going to face if they go along with Carney's plan. So it's rare these days to really see a school district pass an operating referendum on the first try. Mm-hmm. The ones that have done so recently, they're going to have a little more cover to unilaterally raise taxes without going to a vote to cover some of this hit if it does come down this way. But those still in the planning stages are going to face significant voter opposition, I would think.
And you would see Colonial, which has got a second chance referendum coming up, perhaps be a little bit upset. And even Indian River, which passed its referendum, is already talking about making budget cuts despite getting that referendum. Now you're going to go back to those people and tell them, hey, we're raising your taxes as well. that's going to be tough. And I imagine that we'll also hear from the teachers union and other constituencies about these cuts.
Yeah, Delaware State Education Association already, during the budget presentation, was tweeting out, you know, really you're asking us to do more with less money again. You know, they have already come out in pretty fierce opposition to some of these proposals.
As you mentioned earlier, Carney is already trying something a little different with state employee health benefits. He put that number you mentioned on the table of what they want to save, but he's not offering his preferred method to get there. How is that likely to work with lawmakers?
Right. So there's something called the State Employee Benefits Committee that's made up of budget officials, union representatives, and people who are state employees. And they meet several times a year. This isn't a new thing. They track ongoing costs for the state health care plans and make tweaks as necessary. And they're the ones in charge of what the insurance plans look like for the tens of thousands of public employees. So Carney set them this $6.5 million goal in savings. That could take the shape of less generous benefits or higher copays and deductibles. Premiums could shoot up too, but that's all going to be up to the committee in the coming months.
And he's kind of taking the same approach with grant and aid as well, that he's saying we want to cut about $5 million from grant and aid. But hey, that's up to JFC to decide.
Exactly. So Carney offered up a little more than $40 million for grant and aid, and that money goes to nonprofits, volunteer firefighters, arts and cultural organizations. And in full disclosure, Delaware Public Media receives $90,000 from this bill as well. Mm-hmm. So now his proposal is about $5 million less than the current year's budget. And like you said, he's leaving it up to lawmakers. Keep in mind, this is also just a proposal.
Right.
The Joint Finance Committee could decide not to cut grant and aid and just find that $5 million elsewhere. And we'll learn more when JFC starts meeting again to mark up the budget in May.
And we should note that is not unheard of for JFC to do.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I would say the past 2 years, I believe Governor Jack Markell offered maybe a little bit of cuts to grant and aid, but most of it was backfilled by JFC.
Anything else stand out to you in this budget proposal or the reaction to it?
Yeah, a few things. Under the plan, e-cigarettes would be taxed for the first time. It's kind of a unique tax system that it would fall under. Basically, wholesalers are going to have to pay 30% of the product's cost to the state. So 0 to 30%. Right now, it's at 15%, and that includes things like moist snuff. And other tobacco products. And those would also shoot up to 30%. I'm not sure if this only applies to the vape juice itself, which is what contains the nicotine in the vaporizer, or if it applies to the devices themselves. The other one is a 14% reduction in Medicaid reimbursements for dentists. In Delaware, Medicaid only covers those under 21 as far as dental care goes. And the medical field has long complained about how low these reimbursement rates are. So we'll be watching to see how many dentists maybe stop accepting Medicaid if this proposal does go through. And while Carney has said he wants to stop healthcare costs from rising so rapidly, I mean, dental health is key to overall health. You've got 90% of systemic diseases showing symptoms in oral health. And if Medicaid recipients can no longer see a dentist, these may be short-term cuts that have long-term consequences.
And we do know that there's already kind of an issue with access to dental care in Sussex County, so that kind of just may complicate the problem even more. Do want to ask you about next week. There's going to be a speech from Governor Carney to a joint session of the General Assembly. What does Carney do there? Most years we get the state of the state first, this type of speech, setting a tone, and then we move to the budget. We're flip-flopping that this year. What does he try to do in this address?
I mean, conceivably, he's going to lay out his legislative priorities, but right now he's really only coming out in favor of spending more money on correctional officers. He wants to hire more prison guards, bump up their pay. Officers Union says it's nowhere near enough and they're insulted by the proposal. All other reforms Carney has spoken about really are taking place administratively. We know what he said on the campaign trail to get elected. He wants to remake Delaware's economy, overhaul the Department of Education, and help ex-offenders get help re-entering society. We haven't heard much of that last one since the prison hostage standoff last month. And with the revenue situation not looking great, he might just have to double down on this budget proposal and save any kind of legacy items or grand plans for later in his term.
All right, James Dawson, thanks for dropping by.
Thank you.
And remember, you can keep up with all of James Dawson's coverage of politics here in the First State online anytime at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. Senator Tom Carper joins us next on The Green here on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. It's been an eventful week in the nation's capital. The House GOP's proposal to repeal and replace Obamacare limped along, struggling to find the votes needed to pass in the Republican-controlled House. Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch faced marathon questioning from senators in his confirmation hearing. And there's the ongoing debate over President Trump's proposed budget and the cuts it includes. We sat down Friday morning with Senator Tom Carper to discuss these issues. I wanted to start by quickly touching on some of the headlines this week on Capitol Hill, and beginning with the House GOP bill to repeal and replace Obamacare. As we're speaking now Friday morning, it appears there will be debate and a vote sometime later today. But what I wanted to ask you is, what does the difficulty that the GOP leadership and President Trump have had wrangling the needed votes in a GOP-controlled House say to you about the fate of this bill ultimately and the future of Obamacare?
What the House is doing, again, on a controversial and difficult issue, is trying to pass major legislation that is not even close to being bipartisan. And then somehow the Republicans, under the leadership of Paul Ryan, are trying to cobble together a majority of 218 votes, and with no Democratic support, and with a badly splintered Republican majority, is a hard thing to do. In Delaware, we're pretty good at the three C's: communicate, compromise, collaborate. And this is an issue that just cries out for that. But the Congressional Budget Office tells us that everybody won't be covered, and rather like 14 million people in the next year or two will lose their coverage, and another 6-8 million beyond that in the years to follow. The one of the things they do agree on is that there would be a very substantial tax cut that flows from this legislation. It's some people say it's a tax cut for very wealthy people, masquerading as health care reform. So it's just interesting to see that undercurrent that's going on here.
I do want to move on to the confirmation hearing for Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch. What did you take away from all of that, and will you filibuster a vote on Judge Gorsuch?
What I've said to anyone who's asked me this week in Washington, reporters asked me how do I feel about the Gorsuch nomination. I don't believe we should move forward on the Gorsuch nomination until we have dealt with fairly with the nomination of Merrick Garland. Highly regarded jurist, highly regarded by Republicans and by Democrats, nominated by former President Obama with almost a year to go on President Obama's term. And Republicans declined to even, for the most part, meet with Merrick Garland, denied him even a hearing, the courtesy of a hearing. And I thought the way he was treated was shameful. He would have been a great Supreme Court justice, and I'm not prepared to consider the nomination of Mr. Gorsuch until we also agree to reconsider, to actually finally to consider the nomination of Merrick Garland, and just to kind of ignore what happened, you know, for the last year with Merrick Garland. I think would be wrong. A great wrong was committed against him, I think against our country, against the Constitution, and that needs to be righted. That wrong needs to be righted.
I want to move on to the Trump budget. One of the areas you've been especially vocal about are cuts that would impact the environment, especially the EPA, zeroing out the Chesapeake Bay Restoration Program. And the Trump administration has kind of couched this as an effort to return these efforts to protect the environment back to state and local governments. But I guess the question I have is that likely to happen? And I asked that in the kind of the frame of a couple years ago, former Governor Markell tried to get legislation passed to fund a cleanup of Delaware's waterways to no avail. And that was in better budget times. So it seems like, at least from the Delaware perspective, there would be a disconnect between returning efforts to protect the environment and clean up waterways and such without support from the federal government via the EPA or any of these other programs that are on the chopping block.
Yeah, the pollution that comes to the East Coast from Virginia all the way up to Maine is air pollution, as a prime example. It does not emanate, it does not begin on the East Coast. It begins in the Midwestern part of our country. So the very premise on which these cuts of EPA would say, well, let's just let states do what they want to do. Well, it turns out air pollution recognize borders. Water pollution does not recognize borders. Our friends over here in Maryland with the Chesapeake Bay, For a number of years, Delaware was not a good neighbor. And we take poultry manure out of chicken sheds up and down the state, mostly the southern part of the state. And we'd spread it out on the fields very thickly in the rain, and the phosphorus and nitrogen in the chicken manure would wash off into the ditches and the streams and the rivers and the lakes, and eventually all over to Chesapeake Bay, and degrade the quality of the Chesapeake Bay, make it hard for people to make a living there anymore. And we've cleaned up our act. Mm-hmm. It's been farmer-led. I'm very proud of what's happened. We started my last term as governor. We've made great progress, and we're a much better neighbor than Pennsylvania. On the other hand, they continue to foul and pollute the Chesapeake Bay. That's not right. That's not fair. And again, if you say leave it up to Pennsylvania to fix their problems in order to help their neighbors, they may not do that. That's why we have this federal approach. It's not just the federal government telling states what to do, but it's a partnership with the EPA, with the Delaware Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Control. It's a partnership.
Also, a lot was made of funding for Meals on Wheels, and the administration's argument there was that programs like that were showing no indication of results. Also, after-school programs, school meal programs. How do you respond to that?
There's a verse of scripture in the New Testament, Matthew 25. It refers to the least of these. It says, "When I was hungry, did you feed me? When I was thirsty, did you give me to drink? When I was naked, did you clothe me? When I was sick and in prison, did you visit me? When I was a stranger in your land, did you take me in?" And I think we have a moral obligation to look out for the least of these. Since we don't have unlimited dollars, unlimited resources at the federal level or at the state level, what we need to do is to find ways to meet that moral obligation to the least of these in cost-effective ways. I believe we do that. I delivered Meals on Wheels about a week ago in right. Sussex County, Georgetown. The fellow that we visited in his 80s, he was in Vietnam way before I was in Southeast Asia. He was a naval flight officer in the early 70s. So he was there more than a decade before me. And he was in a unit where 4 out of every 5 Marines was wounded, many killed. And he still today has psychological challenges that he faces, and he's helped by the VA on that. He and other people are alive today in no small part because every day, 5 days a week, a volunteer, not a paid person, a volunteer, brings a meal, maybe 2 meals, and on weekends a couple of extra meals so that he can get through the weekend. He lives by himself, and he is deeply grateful, tearful, for the help he gets, the care. And why should we take that away? We shouldn't.
I'm curious if you think part of this is in somewhat a calculated approach by the administration to shift what would be considered the middle ground. That, for example, you propose defunding the Chesapeake Bay Restoration Program, then come back and compromise at 50%, which would still be a major cut. Do you worry that that's perhaps the calculation that's being made with a budget proposal like this?
Well, I think when you have big budget deficits, which are in this state, and a number of states are in that situation, or in the federal government, we need to look at everything we do, and ask this question: how do we get a better result for less money? I'll never forget having a town hall meeting when I was a congressman. We're having a town hall meeting focused on budgeting, the need for spending restraint across the board, and also the needs for some revenue. So I'll never forget a woman in the back of the room. She raised her hand. She says, "Congressman Carper, I don't mind paying some extra taxes. I just don't want you to waste my money." And GAO, every year, beginning of every other year, at the beginning of Congress, gives us a high risk list. And what I've done for years is use that as the leader, Democratic leader of the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs, to find out how do we reduce waste, eliminate as much of it as we can. And that shouldn't be a Democratic issue or Republican issue. That's just a smart issue.
Thanks to Senator Tom Carper for joining us. You can hear the full interview online at DelawarePublic.org. And next up on The Green, can Delaware reboot efforts to develop offshore wind farms? One state lawmaker thinks so. We'll hear why after the latest news from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Nearly half of the world's offshore wind production is in the United Kingdom. The UK's investment in wind energy has significantly driven the cost of this source of electricity down and spurred technological advancements that will make it quicker, cheaper, and easier for the US to build its own wind farms. State Representative John Kowalko just returned from a trip to the UK to see firsthand how it became the world leader in wind energy and what the UK could teach the first state about building offshore wind farms along its coast. Kowalko sat down with our James Morrison and explained his plans to make Delaware a leader in offshore wind, even though past attempts here have stalled.
I see that the UK right now, just looking at like from country to country, that they're producing look like half of the world's wind energy. And so I'm just wondering what's going on with offshore wind in the United Kingdom, and then what are some of the lessons that we could learn here in Delaware?
Well, there's quite a few things going on. One is certainly the fact that it's an island and that it has the best wind in the world, continuous and constant and consistent, I guess would be the right word. And it blows hard enough where it generates a lot of electricity. So the investment has been made and committed to by the United Kingdom to expand this offshore wind generation capacity, I think, to eventually wean itself from fossil fuel. They realize, I think, that the British have retaken the lead on, I guess, on innovation. We've sort of been sluggish in our willingness to understand that it's not all about dollars and cents and the cost in the moment of a kilowatt hour, but what it is about long-term sustainability of costs and a balance of that cost against the environmental consequences and certainly against the legitimacy of fossil fuel generation capacities for electricity.
And I did want to follow up on this because if you are just looking at pure kilowatt hour costs, then I was looking at a graph and it does look like, you know, offshore wind is one of the more expensive ways to produce that energy, and then it's also you're dependent on when the winds are blowing as opposed to something like nuclear that you can always have going 24/7. But there is this investment in wind energy in the United Kingdom, and then also with Rick Perry in Texas, and I saw that Texas and Oklahoma are some of the leading producing wind states. And so what is kind of driving this switch to offshore wind? Is it this renewable energy source?
Well, I think in the case of the United Kingdom, and certainly in the case of Texas and Oklahoma, it's the appreciation of wind being a consistent generator of electricity and also, in the long run, eventually a cheaper generation capacity. But they have much, much more onshore wind per capita than I think that even we have in the United States. And that's certainly to take advantage of the offshore wind prospects. You're going to get much more consistency and sustainability of generation capacity because the winds are blowing constantly offshore.
Yeah, and I was reading this paper, too, that was saying that off the coast of Delaware, this Mid-Atlantic Bight is what they were calling it, that being able to have this interconnected series of wind turbines up and down the coast from Virginia to Rhode Island would be able to produce enough energy for all of the United States. Is that the amount of energy we would be able to get? Or
No, I think that it's a very healthy goal that we could accomplish with offshore wind only. Providing of 20% of the East Coast electric needs. Now, the consequence of that is that the East Coast of the United States consumes the most electricity. So to be able to displace the need for fossil fuel generation of the kilowatt need is certainly something that we should be looking at, and that can expand, I guess you call it exponentially. My ambition, I think the world's ambition, should be that we have those things that are generated by renewables accessible through a grid. All of these things can't help but help relieve the pressures of the demand for electricity. And the demand for electricity, as much as we try to reduce our use of electricity, is never going to just go away. We're always going to need electricity.
Yeah, and so and I just want to touch on a couple more of the potentials for wind energy and then kind of get into a little bit of some of the hurdles that we have to get over to maybe make this a reality on the East Coast. You're looking at not just creating energy, but that also this could bring manufacturing jobs, maintenance jobs, administrative jobs. What is the potential for that with, I guess, scaling up a clean energy like offshore wind off the coast of Delaware?
I think the potential is unlimited. Now, when I say unlimited, I mean in that area. a couple opportunities. One, the immediate opportunity would be if we use the United Kingdom's pipeline. It's established where they're making the products there. They're importing the turbines from Germany, but they can send it over here fully accompanied by the assets to install it. What that does is, in the immediate thing, it gives us jobs for installation and jobs for maintenance and jobs for operation. And those would be here. That would be the immediate. Now, I've talked to Siemens, who manufactured the turbines, I guess about 6-7 years ago when I was in a conference in Washington, D.C., and I just explored with them what would be the mindset of expanding offshore wind, not just at Delaware, but along the entire East Coast. And they said if they could get that big a commitment for a market share for their product, they would move their facilities, some of their facilities, manufacturing these turbines, the gearboxes, and the other things, to the United States, because that's where it is. It's cheaper than shipping it.
I see. Yeah, so rather than shipping it across the ocean, they would just move and start manufacturing
exactly,
here.
Exactly. It's not a easy feat to ship these things even out to the site. It's remarkable. I think I was told at one of the meetings that the ships, the installation ships, they can put one of them up in less than 24 hours at sea.
Oh, wow.
So you can imagine the opportunity for job growth for people manning the ship, the port facility in Delaware. And I don't like to isolate Delaware, because that was my dream if we were the first ones. If we were the first ones in place 8 years ago, with the power purchase agreement we had that people would die for today, to have that same kind of power purchase agreement, if we didn't run into problems and had integrated that into our phone, we would be sitting, you know, perfectly for job creation here. So my intention, my hope is that we can bring the enthusiasm and the less restrictive atmosphere of the UK product, the way they've done it here, because I think it's like a $1 billion investment they made in Hull. And the consequences of that was in Hull, England, where they had a 15.6, I think, unemployment rate, they're down to 3.5 now.
Oh, wow.
So it's almost miraculous what can be accomplished.
I'm speaking with Delaware State Representative John Kowalko about a recent trip he took to the United Kingdom to learn how they became a world leader in offshore wind production. Doing a little bit of research, I was seeing Governor John Carney. He's a big supporter of wind energy. And then even Rick Perry, who's now running the energy department, I read this quote that President Trump told him, "I want you to do for American energy what you did for Texas." And Texas now produces more wind energy than the next three states combined. And so the winds politically could be blowing in the right direction to get this going in the future. Is that how you see it, or do you still see
it? I see it that way, except that I was given pause when I saw a recent headline, I think it was USA Today, probably 2 weeks ago, and it referred to Trump thinks that offshore wind power is ugly, meaning aesthetically, you know what I mean? Which is probably based in the argument he was making in England on his Scottish golf course. I'll be honest with you, I don't think the man I'm not trying to be disrespectful. I don't think he has an appreciation of aesthetics or a knowledge of what is aesthetically appealing or what would be apparent aesthetically. Unfortunately, we have to get beyond that. And I don't think that he's positioned to stop this, but now we have to get a little enthusiasm in the rest of the government. A couple of things that stood in the way of the development off the coast of Delaware. One was a failure to have a permit system which could be expedited here. When all the work was done on the site and it was shown that it's consistent, that it's not going to disaffect the environment or the ecology, the permits should have been expedited then.
And these are federal permits, right?
Yes, federal permits, when you're going off into federal waters. And that's an obstacle that should be overcome and should be less politicized.
One thing that I did want to touch on, too, is that I think came up when you were in the United Kingdom during those 5 days, is opposition from fisheries, the shipping industry, and environmental groups worried about the impact of large wind farms off the coast and what that might be for birds or marine animals or even being able to navigate ships into ports.
Yeah, and they have a system set up there that's, I think, very specific They insist on all the projects that there's a pathway through for major shipping. So they've actually overcome the question that has been asked many times, is what if it's in a major shipping lane? Some of those are in major shipping lanes, but they have the permits issued and the agreement of the installers that they're going to have a wide enough shipping lane between those so they can go back and forth. They said that most of the fishermen exceptions are being answered, and certainly I think they've stopped a project here or there with concerns about that. But most of the fishermen's concerns would be if they run into one of these things, and they'd have to be pretty poor captains to run into these things.
Yeah.
But yeah, they have an agency that actually separately evaluates these things before they're given final approval. And that's the Maritime Coast Guard.
I see. Yeah, and I saw the pictures in that, so that. These, the turbines, they're separated enough where a ship looks tiny compared to these things.
Yeah.
It's almost like roads going between power lines.
Exactly.
Like you don't even think about
it. And that's one of the problems they're trying to address now with the floating platforms and the cable systems as far as, and that certainly hasn't been, I don't want to say addressed, but it's been being considered as we speak. How would the four anchoring cables be in the face of migratory patterns of whales, for instance?
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Undersea. I mean, you could, you know, that has to be a consideration. But yeah, there it's an ongoing, thought process, and with given consideration to protect the environment, number one, and to protect the industries that may be disaffected, to answer their questions, to answer their concerns, to certainly look into it.
Is there a realistic time frame? I know that this is all intangible at the moment. I mean, what are the next steps? Is there something that you're taking to the governor? Is there something that may help get this going soon in the near future here on the East Coast?
I think my task here is to bring back the message in a more simplified form of the advantages, how they're doing it, how they're taking advantage of those of the situation in UK, how they've managed to facilitate these things, show just for the record the precipitously dropping costs per megawatt hour of offshore wind, and then if you make it a favorable government atmosphere. You'll get companies that will salivate over the opportunity to come here. I said it over there in England as we talked. I told them about our power purchase agreement we had in Delaware, which we went through about a year of stutter stepping to finally get signed by all parties. And I said, if I had that piece of paper in hand, that's expired, I think, a year and a half ago. And NRG was the last owner of that. Blue Water Wind was the original owner. And if I had that piece of paper in hand now and handed it to a company like Siemens or E.ON or one of these other companies or corporations that's building these offshore wind, they would jump in a heartbeat at being able to just change some of the numbers in there and say, here you go. We agree to this. I mean, that's an investment. That was an investment possibility, a legitimate investment possibility for 3.3, I think, megawatts at the time. These things generate 9 now. Eight and a half megawatts, 9, and they think they're going to go over 10 each unit. It just gives you a lot of hope that not only is the cost going to become dramatically lower, but also we're going to have a much more bigger effect on our needs, our generation needs, and I want the United States to be part of that.
Representative Cuoco, thanks so much for talking about this with me today.
My pleasure, certainly, and I thank you for having the interview, and I guess our British forefathers finally have a chance to show us something new as far as a lesson plan, you know?
And our thanks to our James Morrison and State Representative John Cuoco for their time this week talking about the potential of offshore wind here in the First State. The Green continues momentarily with our latest arts playlist, which looks ahead at what will be on the playbill at the Delaware Theater Company in its upcoming 2017-2018 season. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. The Delaware Theater Company has announced its lineup for the 2017-2018 season, And in our latest arts playlist, our Mark Earhart talked with Andy Truscott, the company's director of marketing and development, about what people can expect from the DTC in the coming year.
It's a new year for the DTC, and the company recently announced its 2017-2018 season. What can people expect?
People in Delaware can expect another great five-show season, four of the five shows which are regional or world premieres. So we're continuing this idea that our patrons here in Delaware and the Brandywine Valley can enjoy shows here at the Delaware Theater Company that they'll never have experienced somewhere else.
And you mentioned those few regional premieres and world premieres. So this is the first time anybody in the Mid-Atlantic is going to see some of these shows, probably.
Absolutely. And we'll start our season with our world premiere, which is a musical version of Ray Bradbury's Something Wicked This Way Comes. It's been adapted into a play before, but this is the first time it will be adapted into a musical. And this specific entity will continue our tradition of developing new work for Broadway or off-Broadway transfers. This show is being developed here with the idea that there is a further life for it.
So it's kind of like the minor leagues and Broadway being the major leagues, if we're going to use that metaphor.
Absolutely. And this is a bit of the new reality of developing a new Broadway musical, is instead of the commercial producers putting in a ton of money in order to tour it around the country, they now come to regional houses such as Delaware Theater Company or someone a little further south of us, the Signature Theater Company in Arlington, Virginia. They go to these regional theaters, which have a significant subscriber base and already have marketing departments, where they trust the artistic director enough to say, here's our production, now let's see what it's like if you put it on. And the hope, obviously, is that that artistic director and that production that's developed is the production that moves to Broadway. That's our end goal.
And this isn't the first time this has been attempted. There have been previous kind of minor league shows that that you guys have had that went to Broadway, right?
Correct. So we started this vision back in 2015 with a new musical called Because of Winn-Dixie, which actually transferred down to Alabama Shakespeare Festival in the last few months. And the belief is that that production that they continue developing down there will be the one to move. This season that we're in right now, we developed a few shows with this idea. Naturally, we had Diner by Sheryl Crow last year, which broke 38-year box office records for us. And this year, we developed Warren Adler's The War of the Roses, a new play with its eyes set for Broadway. And quite recently, we transferred our February production of White Guy on the Bus by a Philadelphia playwright, Bruce Graham, off-Broadway to 59 East 59th Street, where it's currently running for another 4 weeks.
So what else can you tell us about Something Wicked This Way Comes? We touched that. It's a Bradbury story, and it's been adapted to a play before, but how is that going to translate into a musical?
I think that's the fantastic part, is that because we're still in development of it, there's still so much that's up in the air. So we have a script. We have a score. We know both the book and the music writer, Neil Bartram and Brian Hill. And so we look forward to welcoming them back. We actually produced one of their shows in our 2013-2014 season. But Something Wicked This Way Comes, based on the Ray Bradbury novel, is about a small town where a mysterious carnival comes to town. And specifically in that carnival, there is this merry-go-round where when it goes one way, you get older. When it goes reverse, you get younger. It's a perfect kind of coming-of-age story about these two young boys and how they come into the reality of what the real world is. And so I think this is going to be perfect for kids of all ages. You know, obviously with Bradbury, he's in curriculum, so many of students may have already read the book. And what a great way to kind of continue that literary journey than to see something come to life on stage. And so they've actually just contracted an illusionist, so there'll be some magic that's happening on stage, as well as the production quality that audiences have come to expect from the Delaware Theater Company.
Something Wicked This Way Comes, that starts in September, runs through October of 2017. But in November, you've got something pretty ambitious, I'd say, the complete works of William Shakespeare, and that's abridged. How are you going to shove 37 plays into around 90 minutes?
I think this is one of my favorite shows. It's actually, I think, one of the first shows I saw as a student up at the Pennsylvania Shakespeare Festival. This is a show written by three gentlemen, and it's a two-act show. So without ruining anything, I can tell you that all 36 plays gets shoved into the first act, and in the final act, we only deal with one, which I think is always my favorite. And so it is absurd, it's crazy, but it's something that's so accessible and fun in the holiday season when I think we all just need a really great laugh.
You have another regional premiere called Heisenberg that starts next February, and now it's not a Breaking Bad musical or anything, right? It's kind of a London set comedy?
It is, correct. So Heisenberg, which actually was just done as a development piece, much like it is that we're trying to do here at the Manhattan Theater Club, starring Mary Louise Parker, and it transferred to Broadway shortly after MTC developed it. And so this will be, we are the first regional theater that has contracted this play after it's come off of Broadway. And I think what we really enjoy about Heisenberg is that it is a play that is very much focused on the text and the actors. There's very little that has to be built design-wise on stage for this show. In fact, I'm pretty certain that the design just includes two tables and chairs. And it's a really great return of focus onto some really great playwriting and some really fantastic acting. And so a play like Heisenberg, which deals with the Heisenberg uncertainty effect, it's kind of that great piece for our subscribers or for that theater goer who really likes an intellectual night out. This is a piece that returns us to focusing just on really great playwriting instead of huge productions.
What else can people expect in the 2017-2018 season?
To rewind a little bit, in October of this year, we'll be doing a regional premiere of a new play called Dare to be Black, which is written and performed by Tommy Moore. And it is the historical story of the Jack Johnson story. Jack Johnson was a famous boxer who was actually arrested and persecuted for having a white girlfriend in the civil rights time period. And so before Muhammad Ali, before Sugar Ray Leonard, there was Jack Johnson. And this one-man show really will allow us to experience his quest for equality and has never really seemed more timely than it is right now. You know, Tommy has worked on this play for a few years. We're actually excited to share that we'll be doing a small presentation of it this summer down at the new African American Museum. Bud Martin, our artistic director, will be directing the show. And I think this is just a really great way to continue the conversations that we started having with White Guy on the Bus here at Delaware Theater Company. And these shows, like Dare to be Black, allow us as a community to come through and talk about either any progress that we've made since stories like this have come to truth, or any work that needs to be done to make our community a more equal place.
Andy Truscott, thanks for your time.
Thanks to our Mark Earhart and the Delaware Theater Company's Andy Truscott for their time this week. You can learn more about DTC's new season and how to get tickets at city-theater.org. And stay with us. Enlighten Me is next with a look at how President Trump's budget cuts could impact the Delaware Sea Grant program at UD. This is Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. As a state on the Atlantic seaboard with low elevation, Delaware is especially concerned with coastal issues, ranging from storm damage and erosion to oyster marketing and a buildup of microplastics in the Delaware Bay. Those issues and how to address them are the focus of the Delaware Sea Grant program at the University of Delaware. But Delaware Sea Grant and 32 other Sea Grant programs in the U.S. face an uncertain future under President Trump's recent budget proposal. That budget plan cuts $250 million in funding for National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration grants, including the entire Sea Grant program. In this week's Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media Science reporter Katie Pikus explains what that would mean for coastal research in the first state.
Jonathan Cohen is carefully loading microscopic plastic fragments collected in Delaware Bay near the Cherry Island landfill onto a glass slide. He then places the slide on a scanner to get a closer look at what he's collected.
All those little plastic pieces, which you can obviously see with the naked eye, they're varying sizes. They're all microplastics, so there's fibers there, there's larger fragments, there's a microbead.
Cohen is trying to understand how microplastics have been dispersed throughout the bay and how they affect things like fish that eat them.
The work that we're doing right now is hopefully going to lead to that, to stronger collaborations with fishermen to understand how microplastics could be affecting fisheries that they're depending on. Because we certainly don't want a situation where if microplastics do become a larger issue in crab fisheries or oyster fisheries, for the fishermen to be sort of caught blindly by that.
Cohen works with three graduate students and a technician. Their project has received 1 year of funding through the Delaware Sea Grant. It's work that would be largely impossible if President Trump's proposed cuts to the Sea Grant program are enacted. Cohen and his students' research on microplastics would stop, and they'd shift their focus to other projects that could find funding elsewhere.
It's disconcerting. There's a lot of important questions that scientists are addressing, and there's a lot of interesting and important questions that the state actually has raised, that organizations like Sea Grant can be a meaningful conduit of connecting the state to universities.
While Cohen can only wait to see how the budget shakes out, the University of Delaware is taking a more proactive approach. Mohsen Beatty is the acting dean of UD's College of Earth, Ocean, and Environment, home to Delaware Sea Grant. He's meeting with Sea Grant staff to assess the possible impact of the proposed cuts here.
There's a sense of anxiety among all the programs that what impact these cuts would have in their local communities and to the research that they have been providing all these years.
In 2016, Delaware Sea Grant distributed $1.1 million in federal money to support 19 research projects. It also gave $200,000 to extension and education programs and $82,000 to community outreach. The money supported 9 graduate students and 1 fellow. If that funding disappears and projects like Cohen's go away, Beatty says Delaware's coast could see dramatic changes without the resources to explain them.
In times that environment is changing and we need to adapt to that change, we need to be able to do research and be proactive with that kind of change, and so that we can adapt in a logical manner and manage that adaptation rather than just let the environment do things that we are not able to control.
Scientists are looking to Congress to intercede and make changes, producing a final budget much different from the Trump administration's blueprint. Delaware Sea Grant's Director of Environmental Public Education, Mark Jolly Van Bodegraven, is trying to be optimistic.
The National Sea Grant Program and all of the state Sea Grant programs, as we're discussing moving forward, feel that we can make the case very effectively to the public and to the congressional delegations that what we do is valuable, it's cost-effective, makes a real impact locally.
For now, Jonathan Cohen says he and his students will plug away at their research on microplastics.
There's not much we can do but continue our work. We have funding on projects and we have obligations on those projects, and those projects are leading to interesting findings, and that's what we're trained to do.
Katie Pikus, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Katie, for enlightening us this week. And that's all we have time for on The Green this week. These stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. You can find them on The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website and on iTunes. We also want to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, Delaware Public Media's Mark Earhart, James Dawson, James Morrison, and Katie Pikus, as well as our president and station manager, Casey Howes. For all of them and the rest of the Delaware Public Media staff, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.